From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
We believe in redemption. We believe in rehabilitation. We believe in mistakes. But redemption is not limited to President Bush's nieces in Florida. Redemption should be good in Albany and Rochester and Buffalo and New York for everybody's niece.
And daughters, once again, news, the Bush daughters are in the news for their alleged drug use. As the Rockefeller drug laws turn 30, Jenna and Barbara don't need to worry. It's mostly poor people and people of color who are sent to prison for years of possession. And will President Bush invoke executive privilege to keep documents relating to September 11th out of the hands of a congressional investigative panel? We'll talk to a man who lost his wife in the attacks and is preparing to sue the White House. But first, what happens to a high school history teacher who is a pacifist?
On April 9th, a former RTC teacher who is now a Barrytown policeman decided to come to school and convinced a custodian to let him get into the school and then into my classroom at 1:30 in the morning.
He'll tell his story. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration plans to put forward a UN resolution that would designate the U.S. and Britain as the, quote, occupying powers of Iraq and would officially authorize a U.S.-led occupation. The proposal would end U.N. control over Iraq's oil revenue and let the U.S.-led coalition take control of the country's vast oil wealth to help finance its reconstruction with international oversight. The proposal also calls for the immediate lifting of sanctions against Iraq and would phase out the Oil for Food humanitarian program over 4 months. The program has been feeding 90% of Iraq's 24 million people. President Bush also is set today to call for a U.S. Middle East free trade area that the White House hopes to build gradually over the next decade. The president's expected to announce that trade negotiations will begin next month during the World Economic Forum in Jordan. Those conversations will mark the beginning of lengthier talks over what changes Arab nations must implement to qualify for so-called free trade agreements. And month after U.S. forces seized Baghdad, the Pentagon's occupation authority remains plagued by insufficient resources and inadequate preparations. The Washington Post reports this has fueled complaints from Iraqis and doubts about the Bush administration's promise to reconstruct Iraq swiftly and set its politics on a new democratic course. Army Sergeant Keith Hudson, whose 3rd Infantry Division unit patrols Baghdad, said the experience has been frustrating. He said, quote, "I have no answers for the people. I feel like a paid liar. To look these people in the eye and say tomorrow you'll have electricity, and then tomorrow they look you in the eye and say when." Meanwhile, a 26-year-old Army reservist at Fort Drum is facing a court-martial for refusing to receive the anthrax vaccine. Private Camilla Awanowska said she resisted receiving the shots on religious and medical grounds. Awanowska said she considers the shot medically dangerous to children she might have in the future, saying the long-term effects of the anthrax vaccine are unknown. She also said she could not take the vaccine because of the Roman Catholic religion she practices and the respect it accords unborn infants. Meanwhile, the Army is considering an administration release for another female soldier who refused the anthrax vaccine. Private Rhonda Hasley served a 14-day jail sentence and lost her specialist rank following a court-martial last month. The Israeli military yesterday began requiring foreigners entering the Gaza Strip to sign waivers absolving the Israeli army from any responsibility if the army shoots them. Visitors must also declare that they are not peace activists and not connected to the international solidarity movement. This according to the Guardian of London. Foreigners are also being forbidden from approaching security walls near Jewish settlements and from entering parts of Rafah, which the Israeli army considers to be a military zone. The move came hours before an autopsy on British journalist and filmmaker James Miller confirmed he was almost certainly killed by an Israeli soldier, despite the army's assertions to the contrary. Miller was shot in Rafah a week ago. He was the third foreigner killed or severely wounded in Gaza in recent weeks. Yesterday, the British government demanded an Israeli military police criminal investigation into Miller's death and the shooting of another man from Britain by the army in Gaza, Tom Herndl, a peace activist. Meanwhile, in Baghdad, two U.S. soldiers were killed and a third injured in separate incidents yesterday. The Pentagon said one was shot dead by a sniper, the other was shot and killed while directing traffic on a bridge. Senate Democrats yesterday defeated an attempt by Republicans to make permanent the sweeping surveillance and policing powers of the 2001 Patriot Act. Several provisions are set to expire in 2 years. Also yesterday, the Senate voted 90-4 to expand the government's ability to use secret surveillance tools against suspects who are not thought to be members of known terrorist groups. Under current law, federal officials must establish a link to a foreign terrorist group in order to secure or request a secret warrant. Al-Qaeda has reconstructed itself and is planning spectacular attacks against the United States. This according to an interview obtained by London-based Arabic Al-Majalla magazine, which has previously reported contacts with the organization. Halliburton, the oil industry giant once run by Vice President Dick Cheney, yesterday admitted one of its subsidiaries had paid $2.4 million to a Nigerian official in return for tax breaks. The company said it had informed the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission of the improper payments to the official. Halliburton officials claim the payments emerged during an audit. The SEC is investigating, and the firm could face a tax bill of up to $5 million in Nigeria. The U.S. Army is denying it ordered the seizure of an Iraqi television station in Mosul, as reported by the Wall Street Journal yesterday. But the military said yesterday they are considering putting a U.S. Army officer and a translator in the station to monitor what goes on the air. An officer told the Washington Post, quote, "Yes, what we are looking at is censorship, but you can censor something that is intended to inflame passions." And CBS News is reporting that the death of NBC correspondent David Bloom in Iraq may have been connected to his receiving the smallpox and anthrax vaccines. Bloom died of apparent blood clot several weeks after getting both vaccines. CBS reports the link between the smallpox vaccines and blood clots has been claimed for years by some researchers, though it's not as widely accepted in the medical community. CBS reports civilians who receive the vaccines are being monitored under a civilian system, and the military is tracking the troops. But it's unclear who, if anybody, is tracking the hundreds of civilian journalists who are embedded with the military during the invasion of Iraq. Bloom's case would make four deaths under investigation for a possible link to the smallpox vaccine. Already considered the risky of its kind, the vaccine may be even more dangerous than anyone thought. Months ago, the government called for the immediate vaccination of 500,000 healthcare workers, but so far only 35,000 workers have been inoculated. And now CBS reports the government may scrap mandatory vaccinations altogether.
We gotta have joy, true in our hearts with strength we can't destroy. People hear us through our voice, the world knows there's no choice. We're making save the children, the little ones who just don't understand.
gotta have peace, Curtis Mayfield, here on Democracy Now! And it's great to have you back, Juan.
And good day to all of our listeners and viewers, Amy. And, you know, Amy, I was in Washington over the weekend, and FCC Commissioner Michael Copps addressed a bunch of journalists and told us that June 2nd, the FCC will definitely issue its final rules that will radically transform ownership of the media in the United States. And as of this weekend, none of the other FCC commissioners had any idea what Chairman Michael Powell was planning in revising the rules. So he was expecting that sooner or later, the other commissioners would also learn what Chairman Powell has in mind. But even the FCC commissioners don't know what the final rules will be, and it's only a few weeks away.
And what's expected to come out?
Well, the most radical transformation of ownership in the history of the mass media, a lot more concentration. The specifics, Chairman Powell has been under a lot of pressure, even by some Republican senators and Congress members, to at least let Congress know what the rules changes he's planning will be before he issues them. But so far he's resisted those appeals, and it's not quite clear yet whether the Senate will hold any hearings between now and June 2nd to try to get some information for the public. Because as you know, 72% of the American people, according to a Pew Center study, don't even know that these rules are under consideration for change. The most drastic changes in media ownership since the FCC was created in the 1930s.
And of course, Michael Powell, head of the FCC, son of Colin Powell, one of the people in charge of the invasion of Iraq. We're going to talk about the war climate that remains in this country. The time was 1:30 in the morning. It was in a small town in Vermont. A local police officer snapping photographs, collecting evidence, hardly makes for an interesting story. Except the uniformed officer was in room 211 of Spalding High School in Barre, Vermont. He had gotten into the school through an unlocked door. The officer who was on duty was not investigating a crime. He was documenting what was going on in the classroom of a history teacher opposed to the war in Iraq. Well, we're joined by that history teacher right now, Tom Treese, whose classroom was targeted by Officer John Mott. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Tom Treese.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Well, why don't you tell us about what happened on April 9th?
Well, everything that I know is from either talking with my administrator or the newspaper, and apparently Mr. Mott, 2 days or a day and a half after a school board meeting on April 7th, went. He says he was on duty. Other people say he was off duty, and he came to school at 1:30 in the morning, and the custodian that let him into the school says that he came to the front door, and Mr. Mott says he came through an unlocked door, and nonetheless, after that, he had to, the custodian unlocked the door to my classroom and let him in after that, and then apparently he took some pictures.
And what are the pictures of?
Well, I've only seen the ones that ended up on Rush Limbaugh's site, and they are a picture of the door to my classroom. They're a picture of a poster that some of my students produced, and they are pictures of what we have here at the high school called the dialogue board. It's just a bulletin board where we post political messages and whatnot. And then a broad picture of my classroom. And that's all. Those are all the pictures that I've seen. Apparently, there may be others.
Now, if this was not Officer Mott's normal patrol assignment, it would seem that he's at least in violation of his own departmental rules about officers are not supposed to be leaving their assigned areas of patrol. So he's at least in violation of that. But it would seem also he's in violation of entering a school in the middle of the night when there's no evidence of a crime being or suggestion of a crime being committed?
Yes, he's out of his jurisdiction. He should not been. No one should be in the school at that hour. The argument is the public building and the time was convenient for him. It's against the law per se, but it's against at least school policy for anybody after hours to be in a classroom that is not escorted by a school official just because there's personal effects and other things in the classroom.
What has been the policeman's explanation for going into your class, and what is the police department's explanation?
I don't know what the police department's explanation is. His Mott's explanation is that he said that the school in some way was hiding what was happening in that classroom, and he wanted to see for himself and also let the rest of the community know what was going on in there. Now, it should be known that on April 7th, the night of the first school board meeting that talked about this issue, our curriculum coordinator invited a group of people up into my classroom. They had a video camera, and the curriculum coordinator walked everybody through. And so his argument is that the school wasn't open, and the school has been open as to what's going on there from the very get-go.
And you have no sense what the police department's response is to this at this time?
No, they
or the school board?
The school board is taking action. I do know that several of the parents that their students, their sons and daughters work were posted on the internet. There is talk of lawsuits because it is against the law to do that. So there is that. The police have apparently said that they dealt with it in their own manner, which I'm not too sure about, because as of this past Monday, Mott was still refusing to release the pictures, and that was an order from the police department. So it's kind of confusing to me as to, well, we dealt with it, but then he's still not following orders.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Times Argus, your local newspaper, and it says that, by the way, we did invite John Mott to be on the program, but he didn't return our calls. It says Mott isn't apologizing for his actions and says he at least temporarily is refused orders from the Barrytown Police Chief Michael Stevens and Town Manager Carl Rogers to supply school officials with copies of the photographs. He said, "I'm going to speak to an attorney first."
Yeah, that he did. As of Tuesday, released the photos, he said he would. In the first place they showed up was on Rush's site. I don't know if the administration has seen those photos or the school board as of yet. So there's some. It's not exactly clear as to what's going on.
But obviously, if he was claiming that he went into the school district as a police officer on some kind of police business, and then he then turns the material that he photographed over to Rush Limbaugh, there's definitely additional problems there. I mean, it seems
right
to me that this is this whole thing is incredible in terms of the misuse of police powers by this individual.
Right. He was claiming that he was on a break, and that he. It was a convenient time for him because of his work schedule. That was the most convenient time for him to go into the school.
At 1:30 in the morning?
At 1:30 in the morning.
So then he was acting as a civilian?
That's his claim.
Breaking and entering?
As a concerned citizen as to the craziness that was going on in my classroom. There's a million rumors, all of them unsubstantiated, baseless rumors about what happens in my classroom. Anybody that's talked to any of my students realizes that that this particular group of people have really no idea what they're talking about in terms of what actually happens in the classroom.
What is on your walls? Can you describe some of the projects of the students and what has been the students' response to what has happened? You're now getting not only local newspaper attention, but national attention.
The work that people are upset about, there was... at the beginning of this past semester, so it would be late January, we did a unit in my public issues class on Iraq, and there were basically three projects that came out of that. One was a debate where we had three different groups. One group said that the United States should use force to remove Saddam. One group said we should go with the United Nations, and the third group was that we should remove our forces or reduce our presence in the Middle East to kind of quell the dissent or the animosity between Arabs and Americans. And so we had that debate. The next part was each student wrote their own papers to how they felt about it using the evidence that they had found. And then the third part was, well, now that you've done the debate, you've done a paper, let's make a poster either for war or against the war, and we'll post them outside the classroom and have a place for students to respond to whatever statement you make. And a group of six students put together a poster that was, they had a picture of Bush superimposed upon this big peace symbol, and it said, you know, put your duct tape to good use and shut me up. And it had a picture of Bush with a big piece of duct tape across his mouth, and then listed underneath that some of the reasons as to why you should not necessarily listen to what the president has to say. The other piece that has gotten people upset is a papier-mâché boot that, ironically, I share that classroom with another student, or excuse me, another teacher. And so this piece of work is from another teacher and his students, and it's a papier-mâché boot that has at the top of the boot an American flag wrapped around it. And the boot is kind of on its heel, and it's coming down, and underneath it is a little Native American doll that these kids had put together, and is trying to hold up the boot as it's getting squashed. And that was in a U.S. history class. And then that's really the only student work that has gotten people upset. People were upset about, I had two stickers on my door to the classroom, that one was an Impeach Bush sticker, and the other was a Vermonters for Bush-Cheney regime change. And then I had a God has blessed the world sticker too. And those things that I put up got people upset.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We will certainly follow this story and see what happens in Barre, Vermont. Tom Treese, high school teacher at Spalding High School in Vermont. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, the September 11th showdown. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Newsweek is reporting President Bush may try to invoke executive privilege to keep key documents relating to the September 11th attacks out of the hands of the investigators with the independent panel created by Congress to probe all aspects of 9/11. Last week, we spoke with Newsweek investigative reporter Michael Isikoff, who said administration officials are waging a behind-the-scenes battle to restrict public disclosure of an 800-page secret report prepared by a joint congressional inquiry. The report details intelligence and law enforcement failures that preceded the September 11th attacks, including warnings given to President Bush and his top advisors during the summer of 2001. This week, Isikoff and Mark Hasenball are reporting that White House Chief Counsel Alberto Gonzalez privately told the chair of the 9/11 panel, Thomas Kane, the former governor of New Jersey, that the White House may seek to invoke executive privilege over documents sought by the commission. Among the most sensitive documents the commission is interested in reviewing are internal National Security Council minutes from the spring and summer of 2001. That's when the CIA and other intelligence agencies were warning that an attack by al-Qaeda could be imminent. The panel's also expected to seek interviews with key players in the Bush administration, such as National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. And the panel will likely request to review debriefings of key al-Qaeda suspects who've been arrested. We're joined now by Stephen Push. He's with Families of September 11th. His wife of 21 years, Lisa Raines, was on American Airlines Flight 77 that crashed into the Pentagon on September 11th. Welcome to Democracy Now, Stephen.
Thank you for having me.
Well, can you talk about the difficulty that the commission is having in getting information and this possibility of the president invoking national security or executive privilege?
Well, we first became aware of this about 2 weeks ago when one of the commissioners, Tim Romer, former congressman who was part of the joint inquiry, the congressional investigation that was done last year, wanted to go to the joint inquiry office and review some transcripts of some secret testimony that was given before the joint inquiry that he had attended, and he just wanted to refresh his memory. And he was barred access to those documents. And what he found out is that the commission staff had agreed to allow the White House to review the documents before they were given to the commission to determine whether the White House wanted to assert executive privilege over any of that material. We found this particularly shocking because this is information that had already been given to Congress. And I don't know if there's any precedent for a president invoking executive privilege retroactively like that. That particular issue blew over because the White House eventually decided not to assert executive privilege over that material. But as you noted in the Newsweek article, the White House counsel's office is threatening to invoke executive privilege over other materials, and it appears that the commission and the White House are heading for a showdown over this.
And in the case of former Congressman Romer, he had already been a participant in the very hearing that that from which these transcripts were developed. So in essence, he'd already been cleared to be able to participate and get the information, so that the idea of barring him from being able to see the minutes of the hearing in which he was involved are particularly troubling, aren't they?
Well, I would argue that the White House had already waived executive privilege once that material was presented to Congress. But the argument that the White House wanted to make is that if any subordinates release privileged information without the president's knowledge, that does not constitute waiver of executive privilege, and that retroactively the president can go back and say that's privileged information and you can no longer see it. And they're also doing something very similar with this 800-page report that the congressional inquiry produced. They're actually trying to reclassify information that was presented in public hearings.
And your reaction to, on the one hand, the president appointed this commission to be able to get to the bottom of any problems that may have resulted in terms of the government's participation or how it knew or what it knew and didn't know, and now all of a sudden they're attempting to keep all of this information from the public.
I believe there's probably a difference of opinion within the White House. I think there are probably some. Initially, the White House was strongly opposed to any investigation whatsoever, even by Congress, and they were also opposed to an independent investigation. Eventually, starting last September, I think at least some people in the White House started coming around to the view that the best policy was just to have the commission and get everything out in the open. But I don't think that is a unanimous opinion, and I think particularly in the legal counsel's office, you're going to see people who are going to be fighting to undermine the very commission that the White House claims it supports.
Well, we have Philip Zelikow, who is the executive director of the commission, saying that, we quote, "we expect to get what we need. We're not going to go quietly into that good night." So it does appear that the stage is set for a clear confrontation between.
Yes, I believe the commission is determined to get the information they need. But there is no bright line test as to exactly what constitutes privileged information. In addition, In this particular case, I think there probably is some information that traditionally would be viewed as privileged. However, the statute that created the commission requires them to do a complete analysis, a complete review of the events leading up to September 11th. That would include what briefings the president had in the summer of 2001. So I don't see how that information could be withheld from the commission and still have the commission perform their statutory function. So that's why I see a confrontation occurring here. I don't think the White House, given the fact that this White House has been very secretive, has tried to increase the power of the presidency by expanding the scope of its privilege, I predict that fairly soon we're going to have a confrontation, perhaps even a court battle, between the commission and the White House over exactly what information the White House is going to let the commission have access to.
Well, Stephen Push, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Stephen Push is with families of September 11th, lost his wife on September 11th, 2001. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Well, 30 years ago this week, the American Indian Movement ended its occupation of Wounded Knee in the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. The siege lasted 71 days, drew international attention to the plight of indigenous people within the borders of the United States. The U.S. government responded to the occupation with a full military siege that included armored personnel carriers, F-4 Phantom jets, U.S. Marshals, FBI, state and local law enforcement, and the development of a corrupt vigilante group of Pine Ridge Reservation natives called the Guardians of the Oglala Nation, or the Goons. Two activist occupiers were killed by sniper fire. About a dozen solidarity activists disappeared when they attempted to run supplies by foot overnight. The settlement is known as Wounded Knee 2.
The occupation of Wounded Knee is considered the beginning of what the Oglala people refer to as the Reign of Terror from 1973 to 1976. Over 60 residents were killed in this period. Their murders went uninvestigated by the FBI, which had jurisdiction. The period culminated in the June 26 shootout, for which Leonard Peltier is still imprisoned. Today, government intrusion and land grabs continue to strip the Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota of their traditional land. An encampment has just gone up along the Missouri River to stop the construction of a landfill and state park on a site where the remains of indigenous people have been discovered.
And we're going to go to that encampment in just a minute. But first, we go back in time with Madonna Thunderhawk, who is a resident of Pine Ridge, who lived on the reservation during the occupation in 1973. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Madonna Thunderhawk.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about what happened 30 years ago?
Okay, well, first of all, I didn't live on the Pine Ridge Reservation at that time. My reservation is north of there. I'm from the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. We're north of the Pine Ridge Reservation. There's altogether there's 9 reservations of Lakota, Dakota, Nakota people. It's not just Pine Ridge, okay? So I get that a lot. You know, people just assume. So okay, 30 years ago, it was an occupation of Wounded Knee. And I believe that for the rank-and-file people that weren't in the so-called leadership circles, to me it was a spontaneous event that was forced on us by the FBI, who were already occupying Pine Ridge Village. As we drove through there on our way to the village of Porcupine, we saw APCs there at that time, and the federal buildings were sandbagged. So we knew something was going to happen, but we were already on our way to another forum. Our people, we were having speak outs for our people because they had no place to go to tell their stories. And to get to the village of Porcupine, we had to go through Wounded Knee. And a shootout started. I was in the middle of a caravan. of I don't know how many, you know, cars were involved, but there was it was a good 5 mile stretch of cars, and we were trapped basically in Wounded Knee, and so that's where we made our stand basically, because the old chiefs that were still alive at that time, that's what they told us. You have to make your stand.
And what was life like there during that 71-day siege?
You young people will never know. It was total freedom. We had very little food. You know, we were concerned about water, all those kinds of things, the physical things. But we tasted what real freedom was. And governing ourselves in that little tiny village for 72 days, we governed ourselves. We were free to do what we had always said we wanted to do. And that's what sustained me for 30 years, to do the community organizing and the Indian rights advocacy that I've done, because I tasted that real freedom that our ancestors had. No wonder they stood and fought for this land. What all indigenous people do around the world is because you get that taste of freedom of who you are. And, you know, we're indigenous to this land. We're not going anywhere.
As we look forward 30 years, we're turning to Faith Spotted Eagle, who is involved in an encampment right now. Can you tell us where you are and what is at issue in 2003?
Okay, good morning. As she said, I am Faith Spotted Eagle. I am in southeastern South Dakota on the Ihangtuan Reservation. In English, they call it Yankton, but it's Ihangtuan. It's a Nakota Dakota band, and we're located near the Fort Randall Dam. And this intrusion of this land grab began in the late 40s when the Pick-Sloan Act was created. And due to environmental racism, all of the dams in the Dakotas were relocated smack on top of Indian communities. And consequently, when they decided to build a dam, they arbitrarily condemned our lands and wiped out dozens of Native communities along the river. And the White Swan community was one that was completely obliterated. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs was not in a role of the trust responsibility that it should have done to warn us of what was coming, and we weren't able to fight back, and it was after the fact. And I remember by the time the water came, I was about 2 or 3 years old, but I do remember our people staying on their lands until the water came and witnessing animals being flooded by the river, because our people even had to rent some of the land in order to stay there until the water came. So consequently, we have a lot of trauma from those memories of being chased from our homeland as recent as the 50s. And I remember the seed was planted in my mind, like Madonna talked about, with the old ones calling us to leadership. When I was 12 years old, I was sitting along the banks of the Missouri River with my father, and he looked kind of mournfully out across that place under the water, and he said, "My girl," he said, "someday you're going to have to stand up for that." And he said, "You're going to have to do something." And I thought, I'm 12 years old. What can I do? But I remembered that day. And 4 years ago, I came across the river, and I felt that intuition in my tummy when I looked across the river and I saw the water had gone down. And somehow I knew that time had come. And that very same day, we received a call that a lot of our ancestors had been uncovered. And we went down to the river and witnessed what should not happen in this country, but continues to happen along the Missouri River. They lied to us and told us they had removed the graves, and there was bone scatter all across. There were at least 35 of our ancestors that were scattered across the bottom of the river. And so we told them to stop the river, and they said, "No, we can't. It's beyond our control. The engineers in Omaha control it." So I called up my Uncle Vine Deloria, who is a famous author now, and he said, "You get up to Sioux Falls, you get a restraining order, and you stop the river." So we did. We set up a camp in the middle of the winter in December. We stayed there 6 weeks. We used the law, NAGPRA, Native American Graves Repatriation and Protection Act, and we were able to reclaim those ancestors and rebury them on a butte above there. At that time, we told the Corps of Engineers, being aware that Senator Daschle, instead of advocating for the tribes for the return of that condemned land, there is a Surplus Property Act in existence where when the government no longer needs land, they can return it back to the tribes. Instead of doing that, Daschle introduced Title VI land transfer, and he transferred that land back to the state of South Dakota, overlooked the tribes. And that land has been the subject of controversy because we told them during the White Swan situation that there's burials all up and down that corridor. And we know it through oral history. We've said it repeatedly. And last June, the state did not listen. That land transfer went through despite our objections in a hurried-up environmental assessment. And they hit the graves again. And they called it an inadvertent discovery, and according to NAGPRA, you have to wait for 30 days. In our mind, it was intentional. To me, that's a felony. We told them they were there. They dug. They violated, again, the remains of our ancestors. So in this burial, by the time they told us, they had already removed four of our ancestors to Rapid City, South Dakota, to their state archaeological center without consultation with us. So we had to summon up funds to file another restraining order to stop them. We had to physically go there and stop the bulldozers last June. Went into court. The judge stopped the construction, but by then they had already removed thousands of cubic feet of landfills into two other sites and plus throughout the campground. So we've been in litigation for the year, and about a month ago, the state is anxious to capitalize on the tourism in these campgrounds. With Memorial Day coming up, they're trying to rush us. They filed an order in the court where they asked for an amendment to the order and told the judge that they wanted to, there were no remains on one of the sites. They did an archaeological grid, which only assesses less than 10% of the land. It's a sample and subject to error. And the judge lifted the order, and on that site, they're wanting to put a fish cleaning station, an RV waste dump, and a parking lot on the top of the remains of our ancestors. The judge granted the order and said they could build there, but they did have to return the fill on the place across the road. So immediately upon hearing that, we set up our teepees, and we told them that we were going to watch over that site, and we're going to continue to be there. We need a lot of assistance, and we've contacted the other tribes to come and set up a lodge, and three or four of them have contacted us because how they treat Yankton is how they're going to treat the rest of the tribes on the river, which is with complete disregard and violation of these federal laws.
Well, Faith Spotted Eagle, both you and Madonna Thunderhawk continue to be actively involved in defending Native American rights, but I'm interested in terms of the young Native Americans these days. What impact does Wounded Knee, obviously, was a long time ago. What impact does this have on their consciousness and on their determination to continue to battle to defend your land?
I am really pleased when the call went out, and I work quite actively with Braveheart Society, which is a old-time society which has been revived for reteaching the strengths of our people, the cultural strengths, and we work with a lot with young people, and the ones that a large portion of the people who have showed up for this occupation are young people. And that really makes my heart happy because there's a lot of young men that really have no place to be a warrior, and they have no place to seek visions because the state has taken all the riverland. The Missouri River is holy to us, and that's where we seek our visions. And we can't go there anymore because when we go there to pray, the state charges us. Last summer, I went down to offer prayers like I have done all my life, and a state Game Fish and Parks vehicle drove up and waited for me. And when I came up to the shore, they asked me, "Did you pay to get in here?" And so, you know, it's just an insult to any cultural practices that we have that we can't even get to the river's edge anymore.
Well, Faith Spotted Eagle, I want to thank you very much for joining us, and Madonna Thunderhawk. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, it's also the 30th anniversary of the Rockefeller drug laws, among the most draconian imposed in this country. We'll hear from, among others, the Reverend Al Sharpton, Democratic presidential candidate. Stay with us.
Bury my heart and wounded knee.
Sydney, Walela, here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Bush daughters have once again found themselves in the news this week for their alleged drug use. Actor Ashton Kutcher told Rolling Stone magazine how a year and a half ago he saw Jenna and Barbara smoking marijuana. He said one night, quote, "I go upstairs to see another friend and I can smell the green wafting out under his door. I open the door and there he is smoking out the Bush twins on his hookah." If the Bush daughters were caught doing this in New York, they could land some serious jail time.
Well, 30 years ago this week in 1973, New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller pushed through the state legislature the first laws in the nation that require minimum sentences for first-time drug users. The Rockefeller drug laws mandate a minimum of 15 years for first-time nonviolent drug users who are caught with small amounts of drugs. Dozens of other states and the federal government rushed to adopt their own versions of the Rockefeller drug laws in the ensuing years after New York State set this precedent. But people like Barbara and Jenna Bush don't need to be too afraid. Most of the people imprisoned by these laws are poor, and most of them are people of color.
That's right, more than 90% of them. Well, yesterday, hundreds of people rallied outside New York Governor George Pataki's offices to call for an overturning of these 30-year-old laws. And before that, there was a news conference that was held. Among the people who spoke, New York Reverend Al Sharpton, the former Secretary of Housing Andrew Cuomo. But we'll start with hip-hop promoter and producer Russell Simmons.
First, let me thank Andy Cuomo for being the first person. I mean, of course, I've been listening to the rumblings of all the organizers for many years. And of course, I have experience that friends of mine were incarcerated when I was young, and they spent many years in jail, and they learned to become criminals, and they became repeat offenders, many of them, because of this unjust law. But then Andy came and said that we had the power and that we should use it, and so we started to put together a coalition. And this is only a few days' work, you know, to have the Reverend Sharpton just walk in and have Susan Sarandon, have Rabbis Foundation for Ethnic Understanding, and Tim Robbins, and, you know, the minister, Kevin here. This is the beginning. Yes, Jason Flom, who's been here from the beginning and has spent a champion. So most of the people on this podium have been championing this cause for a lot longer than the Hip Hop Summit. But we're here today to celebrate, I believe, you know, this the beginning of a coalition, because it's, you know, of course, Senator Clinton and Senator Schumer, and of course, there are many Republican senators and congressmen who are coming on. The entire Black Caucus is here is in spirit and are supporters. But Puffy and Jay-Z and Will Smith and all of those people, maybe I saw the other day in the paper a big story about Damon Dash, who's also on the coalition, his birthday party. And then I saw this little story that had to do with the Rockefeller drug law anniversary coming up. We're going to reverse that. And we're going to educate people over the next 30 days. Yeah. Yeah. Now, Damon's party, I got to admit, was a very good party. So I don't want to take anything away from his party. But the fact is that we want to create an awareness campaign over 30 days. And we want to celebrate the governor, Sheldon, Silva, and Bruno. We want those three to get together. We know that when they get together, they can do what has to get done. And maybe they need support. They need people to know that 88% of the people in New York know these things have to be repealed. Maybe they don't know that 95% of the people incarcerated are Black and brown, which points to the worst case of racial profiling we've ever seen, that I'm aware of, at least. Reverend, you may have to speak to that. But it is unbelievable that we've allowed it to go this long. And when we get the power of hip-hop and the power of all these organizers together, young people and the people who have stood fast, we know that in 30 days that they will get it done. And so we're excited about this opportunity, and I want to thank you all for coming and all of the people, obviously. Oh, I'm sorry, the deadline is June 4th, not quite 30 days. It's got less than 30 days, they have. But we know that, you know, there are three people that we can hold accountable, and we know they can get it done. We know they're talented and hardworking, and they need people's support, and we're the people who want to support them in their effort. So thank you all for coming out, and Ben, you can take
it. Yeah. All right. Russell Simmons, June 4th is the deadline. June 4th. We hope the governor hears this, and we hope the state legislature hears this, because the will of the people will prevail. Next, we would like to call a man who's distinguished himself not only in the recording industry, but in American life, and has been with this issue from the very beginning. Let us meet the president, the CEO of Lava Records, Jason Fromm.
Thank you. I'm very honored to be here at this very important event. I, like many other New Yorkers, didn't know anything about this issue until I read a story in the paper about 11 years ago about a kid that was serving 15 years to life for a first offense nonviolent cocaine possession charge. And I read this and I was outraged because I thought, there before the grace of God go I. And I couldn't believe that a nonviolent kid on a first offense would be serving a much longer sentence than most rapists and murderers do. And I said, I am going to do something about this. I'm going to learn about it, and I'm going to make changes any way that I can. I was successful in helping him to secure his release 6 years before he would have been eligible for parole. Today, he's got 10 employees. He's got a successful business, a couple of kids, and it affected everyone in his family, his parents, his sister, his brothers, everybody. And that's the type of effect that it has when we make a change on one person's life that's in this system right now. I myself was a drug addict, and while I wasn't a dealer, I was in the wrong place at the wrong time so many times that I could have been a victim of these laws, because so many of the people that are in right now weren't dealers either. They were in the wrong place at the wrong time and got caught up in these Rockefeller drug laws and the conspiracy stuff. But I went to rehab instead. 16 years later, I'm sober, a successful businessman involved in this movement, and I can't think of anything that's more important in our state right now or even in the country. I later learned that one of the reasons I was lucky not to have been arrested and lucky enough to be sent to rehab instead was because the law really targets minorities. Yes. It is outrageous that we have 94% of the drug inmates in New York State prison and the Rockefeller drug laws are minorities. This is just a grotesque figure, and we cannot allow it to stand. And I'm so excited to be here today with all of you, because with this fantastic group, and I got to give so much credit to Randy Credico for having assembled this wonderful group up here. We will hold Governor Pataki accountable for the promises that he has made to make these changes, unfulfilled promises for 3 terms now. And June 4th, we'll have our celebration. So thank you.
That's Jason Fromm, president and CEO of Lava Records. Also among those who spoke was the Reverend Al Sharpton, who has long addressed this issue. He is now a Democratic presidential candidate, and he came out for this event, both spoke at the rally outside of Governor Pataki's offices afterwards, and spoke at the press conference. Reverend Sharpton.
Several days ago, when Russell Simmons called, this issue is an issue that for the last several years we've been involved with in National Action Network. And I told him I would be here, and that the rally Randy Credico and others have been working hard on, because I think there's also a level of accountability that many of us have to have in the African-American community. When Lynn Bias died from crack, there was an emotional knee-jerk reaction that called for stiff laws. Those that were right-wing used that opening to put in federal drug mandatory laws and to reinforce laws like the Rockefeller drug laws. We have a responsibility to undo what we in part helped to establish in the first place. Because if we can rehabilitate Enron executives then why are we locking up for decades people that may just be caught at the wrong place at the wrong time? We believe in redemption. We believe in rehabilitation. We believe in mistakes. But redemption is not limited to President Bush's nieces in Florida. Redemption should be good in Albany and Rochester and Buffalo and New York for everybody's niece. If his nieces had to deal with these laws, we wouldn't have to protest because they would understand that. But because it's dealing with people of color and working class people, we have to do this. I think this is a phenomenal coalition because it brings together people who would not normally be together, but who understands the gravity of the problem. You know, there was a time, according to my religious belief, that when God got ready to make a new world, he had Noah build an ark, and they had a 40-day countdown. And on the ark, he put two of each kind. And in reminiscent of that, Russell starts today the launching of a new ark. And he's got a few of each kind. He got some rappers. He has some artists. He has some Oscar winners. He's got some gubernatorial should-have-beens and some presidential's ought-to-be's. He got a bunch of everybody on the ark. And though it may not look to you like they belong together, it's the creation of a new New York, of a new world, of something bigger than any individuals on the ark. Because the ark is not about who's on it. The ark is about where the ark is going. And the ark is going for a 40-day countdown to repeal these laws, to give new opportunities, to reunite families, and to reconcile a criminal justice system that is not fair. So we join on this countdown. We join to get our seat on the ark. We call on the governor and the speaker to make promises made, promises kept. You say you want to repeal the law, well, you can if you will. And if you won't, the people will, because the people have come together across our differences to say we join together for what's fair and what is equal. If we can understand people in high places, then we need to understand people that don't need to be in locked up jail cells. Thank you. God bless. Yeah.
The Reverend Al Sharpton. And that does it for today's program. If you want to get a video or audio copy of the program, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now!'s website, democracynow.org. Our email address, mail, mail, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Ann Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Rybel and Vilka Tsouras. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Special thanks to Kevin McKiernan, who provided photos of Wounded Knee. Thanks for listening. From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Hi, I'm Joellen Raderstorff from Boulder, Colorado, and I'm part of Mothers Acting Up. Mother's Day parades are taking place in cities from L.A. to NYC, Olympia to Albuquerque, Cincinnati to Tampa Bay. Mothers around the country will be realizing Julia Ward Howe's original intention for Mother's Day, a day where mothers gather together to create peace.
Today, a Mother's Day special. We'll hear from women around the country. We'll also hear about a bill congressional Republicans have just introduced that would make it a crime to hurt or kill a fetus. They say it's to protect mothers, but women's rights activists say it will undermine Roe versus Wade.
Well, it's really remarkable as we approach Mother's Day how little our country values mothers and the extent to which pregnant women are not really regarded as full persons under the law.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. The Bush administration plans to put forward a UN resolution that would designate the U.S. and Britain as the, quote, occupying powers of Iraq and would officially authorize a U.S.-led occupation. The proposal would end U.N. control over Iraq's oil revenue and let the U.S. and Britain take control of the country's vast oil wealth to help finance Iraq's reconstruction with international oversight. The proposal also calls for the immediate lifting of sanctions against Iraq and would phase out the Oil for Food humanitarian program within 4 months. The program has been feeding 90% of Iraq's 24 million people. President Bush also is set today to call for a U.S. Middle East so-called free trade area that the White House hopes to build gradually over the next decade. The president is expected to announce that trade negotiations will begin next month during the World Economic Forum in Jordan. Those conversations will mark the beginning of lengthier talks over what changes Arab nations must implement to qualify for the so-called free trade agreements. And a month after U.S. forces seized Baghdad, the Pentagon's occupation authority remains plagued by insufficient resources and inadequate preparations. The Washington Post reports this has fueled complaints from Iraqis and doubts about the Bush administration's promise to reconstruct the country swiftly and set its politics on a new democratic course. Army Sergeant Keith Hudson, whose 3rd Infantry Division unit patrols Baghdad, said the experience has been frustrating. He said, quote, I have no answers for the people. I feel like a paid liar. To look these people in the eye and say, tomorrow you have electricity, and then tomorrow they look you in the eye and say, when? CBS News is reporting that the death of NBC correspondent David Bloom in Iraq may have been connected to his receiving the smallpox and anthrax vaccines. Bloom died of an apparent blood clot several weeks after getting both vaccines. CBS reports the link between the smallpox vaccines and blood clots has been claimed for years by some researchers, though it's not as widely accepted in the medical community. CBS reports civilians who receive the vaccines are being monitored under a civilian system, and the military is tracking the troops, but it's unclear who, if anybody, is tracking the hundreds of civilian journalists embedded with the military during the invasion of Iraq. Bloom's case would make 4 deaths under investigation for a possible link to the smallpox vaccine. Already considered the riskiest of its kind, the smallpox vaccine may be even more dangerous than anyone thought. Months ago, the government called for the immediate vaccination of 500,000 healthcare workers, but so far only 35,000 workers have been inoculated. Now CBS reports the government may scrap mandatory vaccinations altogether. According to CBS, the turnaround comes amid serious and unexpected adverse events in the first people to get the shots. Meanwhile, a 26-year-old Army reservist at Fort Drum is facing a court-martial for refusing to receive the anthrax vaccine. Private Camilla Iwanowska said she resists receiving the shots on religious and medical grounds. Iwanowska said she considers the shot medically dangerous to children she might have in the future, saying the long-term effects of the anthrax vaccine are unknown. She also said she could not take the vaccine because of the Roman Catholic religion she practices and the respect it accords unborn infants. Meanwhile, the Army is considering an administrative release for another female soldier who refused the anthrax vaccine. Private Rhonda Hasley served a 14-day jail sentence and lost her specialist rank following a court-martial last month. The Israeli military yesterday began requiring foreigners entering the Gaza Strip to sign waivers absolving the Israeli army from any responsibility if the army shoots them. Visitors must also declare that they are not peace activists and not connected to the international solidarity movement. This according to the Guardian of London. Foreigners are also being forbidden from approaching security walls near Jewish settlements and from entering parts of Rafah, which the Israeli army considers to be a military zone. The move came hours before an autopsy on British journalist and filmmaker James Miller confirmed that he was almost certainly killed by an Israeli soldier, despite the army's assertions to the contrary. Miller was shot in Rafah a week ago. He was the third foreigner killed or severely wounded in Gaza in recent weeks. Yesterday, the British government demanded an Israeli military police criminal investigation into Miller's death and the shooting of another British man by the army in Gaza, Tom Herndl, who remains in a coma. He is a peace activist. Meanwhile, in Baghdad, two U.S. soldiers were killed, a third injured in separate incidents yesterday. The Pentagon said one was shot dead by a sniper and the other was shot and killed while directing traffic on a bridge. Senate Democrats yesterday defeated an attempt by Republicans to make permanent the sweeping surveillance and policing powers of the USA Patriot Act. Several provisions are set to expire in 2 years. Also yesterday, the Senate voted 90-4 to expand the government's ability to use secret surveillance tools against suspects who are not thought to be members of known terrorist groups. Under current law, federal officials must establish a link to a foreign terrorist group in order to secure or request a secret warrant. Al-Qaeda has restructured itself and is planning spectacular attacks against the United States. This according to an interview obtained by London-based Arabic Al-Majalla magazine, which has previously reported contacts with the organization. Halliburton, the oil industry giant once run by Vice President Dick Cheney, yesterday admitted one of its subsidiaries has paid $2.4 million to a Nigerian official in return for tax breaks. The company said it had informed the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission of the improper payments to the official. Halliburton officials claim the payments emerged during an audit the SEC is investigating, and the firm could face a tax bill of up to $5 million in Nigeria. The U.S. Army is denying it ordered the seizure of an Iraqi television station in Mosul, as reported by the Wall Street Journal yesterday. But the military said they are considering putting a U.S. Army officer and a translator in the station to monitor what goes on the air. An officer told the Washington Post, quote, "Yes, what we are looking at is censorship, but you can censor something that is intended to inflame passions."
Sometimes I feel like a mother, yeah, yeah. Oh, true believer,
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
And good day, Amy, and to our listeners and viewers around the country.
It's great to see you, Juan. Well, Sunday is Mother's Day. Most people don't know this, but the holiday is ancient, dating back millennia. The earliest Mother's Day celebrations in Western history can be traced back to the spring celebrations of ancient Greece in honor of the Rhea, the mother of the gods. In 17th century England, many of England's poor worked as servants for the rich and lived in houses of their employers. On Mothering Sunday, servants were allowed to take the day off and return home to spend the day with their mothers.
In the United States, the earliest version of Mother's Day was Mother's Work Day, and it was initiated in 1858 in West Virginia. During the Civil War, local teacher Anna Reeves Jarvis extended the purpose of Mother's Work Day to work for better sanitary conditions for both sides in the conflict. In 1872, Julia Ward Howe suggested holding an annual Mother's Day. Howe is well known as the author of the words to the Battle Hymn of the Republic. She was horrified by the carnage of the Civil War and proposed establishing Mother's Day as a day dedicated to peace. A year later, women in 18 cities celebrated a Mother's Day for peace, and some continued to celebrate it for the next 30 years. It was Anna Jarvis, daughter of Anna Reeves Jarvis, who was the power behind the official establishment of Mother's Day. She swore at her mother's gravesite in 1905 to dedicate her life to her mother's project and to establish a day to honor mothers, living and dead. She wrote to politicians, clergymen, business leaders, and women's clubs. The U.S. Congress passed a Mother's Day resolution in 1914, but the bill emphasized women's role in the family, not as activists in the public arena, as Howe's Mother's Day had been.
Well, U.S. Congress is once again taking up the issue of mothers and pregnant women. On Wednesday, congressional Republicans introduced a bill that would make it a crime to kill or injure a fetus. The so-called Unborn Victims of Violence Act is sponsored by the staunchly anti-choice Republican Senator Mike DeWine of Ohio and Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania. Santorum's the same senator who made headlines last week when he equated gay sex with incest. He said, quote, "If the Supreme Court says you have the right to consensual sex within your home, then you have the right to bigamy, you have the right to polygamy, you have the right to incest, you have the right to adultery, you have the right to anything." Pro-choice activists say the legislation will undermine Roe v. Wade, and supporters of the bill agree. Republican Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah told CNN, quote, "They say it undermines abortion rights. It does." But Hatch and other supporters say publicly that the undermining of Roe v. Wade is irrelevant. They say the law is important because it would protect pregnant women whose unborn babies are harmed or killed in a federal crime.
The legislation has passed the House twice before, but has languished in the Senate. However, anti-abortion foes are more hopeful this year because of a larger GOP majority in the Senate and public outrage over the highly publicized Peterson case. Currently, 26 states have already enacted laws that make it a crime to kill or injure a fetus. President Bush has indicated recently that he strongly supports the proposed legislation.
Lynn Paltrow is with us. She is the founder of National Advocates for Pregnant Women. Why don't we talk about the legislation and specifically about the Lacey Peterson case that has very much brought the issue of pregnant women to the fore?
Well, I would disagree in the sense that I don't think it's brought the question of pregnant women. It's brought the question of claims of fetal rights to the fore, and that's the problem. In California, where this happened, there's actually been a feticide law for almost 30 years. So in some ways, it's not even news. And I think it's a very politically useful issue because there's no question that when a woman is attacked while during pregnancy and she loses that pregnancy, it is more than. There is something that she's lost and the family has lost, and that absolutely needs to be acknowledged. But what is not getting talked about is the increasing evidence that the leading risk of death to pregnant women is murder. And the focus of the Unborn Victims Against Violence Act is we want to have the born person against violence act. In other words, it will do nothing to, in fact, protect pregnant women from the violence they experience and the deaths that are occurring from that. Let me give you some examples. These laws generally do not result in more money for battered women shelters, for more research on why men seem to be so violent. The research suggests that these attacks aren't about hating fetuses, so it's the wrong focus. It's about controlling women, the fact that during pregnancy it's harder to isolate women because they're expected to get prenatal care and be out in public, which batterers hate. And that when they do talk about attacking the fetus and I'm going to kill your baby, it's because they know it will destroy the woman. And we know about women and pregnant women that they are caretakers, that they do care about their children. And so by attacking them, they are attacking the women. And that's what the conversation should be about. When activists have asked the legislators to even add a section of the bill that would make it a federal crime to kill a woman, they said no. Only the fetus. And we know from their recent work on the unborn, the expansion of the Children's Health Insurance Program to include the unborn, they said that would protect women. And it was just a first step, and then they would increase the program's funding for pregnant women as well. And after they enacted this regulation that defines a child to be a fetus from the moment, include children from the moment of conception, and legislators proposed expanding coverage for all pregnant women themselves, Tommy Thompson, who had said he supported that, now says it's redundant. So there's legislation that protects, provides health care for fetuses for everything they need, but admittedly doesn't cover pregnant women's illnesses that aren't related to the pregnancy, doesn't pay to sew them up after delivery or after a C-section, but it would be redundant to provide cover directly for them.
And for those of our listeners who are not familiar with the Lacey Peterson case and how it's being used in this particular situation, could you talk a little bit about the facts of that case?
In this circumstances, Lacey Peterson is a pregnant woman in her 8th month of pregnancy who disappeared. It is now believed her husband has been accused of murdering her. Her body was found. The fetus at 8 months was that body was found in what's considered a crypt birth. After her death, there was an expulsion of the fetus. And people are appropriately horrified. But the states that have looked at it in a way that seems appropriate say, yes, when you attack a pregnant woman, there should be an enhanced penalty. It is a loss to her. But what's amazing is that these laws do not get used to end violence against women. What they are being used for is to justify greater control and attacks on pregnant women. This Sunday, I'm going to be thinking about Regina McKnight, a woman who at age 22 in South Carolina suffered a stillbirth. She had a lot of problems. Her mother had recently been killed in a car accident. That had been her primary emotional, all kinds of support. She was homeless. She had turned to drugs. She experienced a stillbirth that we know and the South Carolina Medical Association knows not related to any of those behaviors, and yet she was charged with homicide by child abuse for experiencing a stillbirth, and the South Carolina Supreme Court upheld that murder charge, and she was sentenced under a crime that's 20 years to life.
Well, there was a similar to the Lacey Peterson case, not quite the same, but about several years ago, about 4 or 5 years ago, here in New York City, a drunken off-duty police officer hit with his car three people actually crossing the Third Avenue in the Red Hook section of Brooklyn. The woman was 8 months pregnant, and the three people who were crossing the street were killed. Her baby, though, was delivered. And then was delivered dead by the doctors. And so then the courts had to decide whether to charge the police officer with 4 homicides versus 3. They eventually decided on 4 homicides. Do you see any kind of difference in that situation versus the Lacey Peterson case? Or?
Not really. I mean, historically, there has been a difference. There was once a born alive rule. In order to make that kind of charge, the baby would have to be born alive. And then it's been extended backwards. And it's in some ways understandable. People are appropriately horrified by those losses. And they are severe. But what's so interesting is the extent to which people will not attribute, recognize, acknowledge the pain to a woman. There's a recent decision in Connecticut where a man tried to give a woman some kind of drug to cause a miscarriage. And the only way she could recover, according to the court, is by recognizing the fetus as a separate person. The fact that that attack on her desire to become a parent could not even be acknowledged in the law is very typical. I think I want to share one thought, and the reason that we're talking about this. Professor Joan Williams put it very interestingly, and I apologize if I'm paraphrasing wrong, but she said, you know, we're in an age of hypercapitalism, where the social support system, where there's no child care, where income support for poor people is disappearing, where education is being more and more limited. And so that really what stands between an economy and a society that works and one that doesn't is what? The volunteer, unpaid, uninsured, unreimbursed labor of mothers who raise and care for children. By and large, it's women, and we do not support it. Our tax system in every regard undermines it, and yet we will talk about the Unborn Victims of Violence Act, but how can it be that if we value mothers and parenting, that we depend on what is volunteer labor? And what I think in terms of the work that I do is it's really important to keep in the public mind this notion of women as bad mothers, welfare queens, crack moms, murderers, child abusers, or the other victim in the Lacey Peterson case, because as long as we keep thinking of them as bad, then it becomes okay not to provide the support and the reimbursement that they deserve.
Well, Lynn Paltrow, I want to thank you very much for being with us, looking at the pieces about the bill that is being introduced, put forward by Mike DeWine, Senator Mike DeWine of Ohio. They're talking about naming the bill the Connor and or the Lacey and Connor's Law, Connor being the name of that Lacey had chosen for her son.
That's right. And, you know, it's disappointing that the family is supporting this bill, but understandable. The pain and grief and suffering that they're experiencing, people do want to see something changed. But what the focus should be on is, why are we living in a society that allows, you know, women every 15 seconds to be beaten, for the leading cause of death to be homicide? It seems to me if that level of violence was occurring from women, they would have found a drug to address it. But it seems that it is so accepted culturally that we will do anything except focus on why is that violence so prevalent and so accepted. And I would much rather see legislation that addresses the violence against women and values women and understands that these attacks are designed to control the women, to punish the women, and to take away from them something they deeply value. And as long as we're not willing to look at the value of women and their pain and suffering, we will see increasingly the recognition of fetal rights under the law at the same time that pregnant women have yet to be recognized as full persons under the law.
Lynn Paltrow, National Advocates for Pregnant Women. If people want to get in touch with your group, where can they go on the web?
www.advocatesforpregnantwomen, all one word, .org.
And thank you for being with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll hear from women around the country engaged in various Mother's Day actions. And we'll also hear from children who have sent letters to their mother in prison. Stay with us.
Mothers of the earth will finally rest, we'll take their babies in our arms and do our best. When the sun is and the weary mother
listening to Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Last month, 30-year-old Sandra Kelly of Brooklyn, New York, gave birth to a baby girl. She named her Sanaa. The birth took place at Nassau University Medical Center, but just days later, Sandra had to hand over her daughter to a friend because Sandra is in jail awaiting trial on assault charges. Until 6 months ago, the prison, the East Meadow Jail in Nassau, ran a nursery for new mothers. But today, Sandra, who was recently profiled in an article by Newsday, had no choice but to give up her newborn daughter. Kelly said, "I'm angry I can't be with my child. It's not like I'm a bad mother. My kids have always been with me. I don't have any neglect charges against me." She also has two boys, ages 13 and 7, who are staying with relatives. Sandra Kelly has been held in jail for 8 months in lieu of $10,000 cash bail. She's charged with assaulting a woman, but says she's innocent. Unfortunately, stories like Sandra's are not rare. It's estimated 2 million children across the country have a parent in jail. African-American children are nearly 9 times more likely to have a parent in jail than white children. Hispanic children are 3 times as likely as white children to have a parent in jail. Before we go to our guests in the studio today, we're going to hear some letters. Letters from children that are really Mother's Day cards to their moms in jail.
My name is Anthony Garcia, and I'm 12 years old, and I would like to say this to my mother, who's in jail right now, that I feel sad that I'm separated from her and all that. But I know that she's still in my heart, and she's coming out soon because she's not staying in there forever. So I just want her to come home safe and sound and stuff. I'm staying with my father, so he's helping me out, getting through the stress without being through my mother. My brothers and sister, my cousins are helping me. I'm making decisions on my own. I have friends in school and stuff, so I like to thank her and my father for bringing me in. And I hope she come out soon because I miss her very much, and I want her home. I want to see her and stuff. I saw her yesterday, but that's not enough to go see her like every month. I want to see her every day. So I love you, Mom, and I hope you come out soon, and I know you will. I love you, and I know you love me. And I pray for you every night.
Hi, this is Josephine. I'm 10 years old. Hi, Mommy. How you doing? I'm doing well in school. Happy Mother's Day. I love you. And I have a great teacher. She's nice. I like the school. And I try to fix my room and fix my bed. I try to help out the lady. And I've done all my homework, and I'm behaving very well. Happy Mother's Day. I love you.
Hi, I'm Indama Santana. I'm 12 years old. I live in Queens where my foster mother, Coralie Luna, and I'm living fine. And I wanted to say Happy Mother's Day to my mom. And I'm a reader. The card it says, Mother's Day is the one day of the year we set aside just to honor mom. It doesn't make up for the other 364, but it's a start. I love you very much, Mommy. I hope you come out soon. I'm living very fine here. I love my school, the teacher. I do all my homework. I help doing the chores. I love it here. I like my foster sisters and my foster mom, and I hope you come out soon. I love you.
Some of the voices of children talking to their moms in jail. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we turn to our guests in the studio, we're joined by Julie Kowitz, who is director of the Women in Prison Project in New York City, Lisa Turner, who is a former prisoner and mom. She spent 2.5 years in the New York State prison system, and Tanya Krippett, who is director of the Children of Incarcerated Parents Program, the CHIPS program, the Administration for Children's Services of New York City. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Julie Kowitz, can you talk about the Women in Prison Project, the number of women in prison, the issues they face?
The Women in Prison Project is the only project in New York State that's exclusively dedicated to advocating on behalf of women prisoners in both jails and prisons in New York. Women prisoners face a whole host of issues, and obviously the vast majority of them are mothers. 75% of them are mothers of minor children. We've got about 6,000 women total, maybe a little more than that, incarcerated in our jails, county jails, Rikers, and the five New York State prisons. And they are mothers to approximately 13,000 children.
And what does your project do specifically?
We conduct public education and advocacy campaigns on behalf of women prisoners. For example, we conduct advocacy on behalf of domestic violence survivors who are incarcerated. Last year, we were successful in getting the legislature and the governor to enact legislation that would allow domestic violence survivors to be eligible again for the work release program in New York. In terms of what we do for incarcerated mothers, we work very hard to increase the visiting opportunities for incarcerated mothers. Right now, our main policy objective is to convince the state legislature, even in this terrible budget year, to use TANF dollars, temporary aid to needy families dollars, to provide money for programs to help children visit their mothers across the state.
And what are the visiting rights compared to, let's say, normal, to other members of families visiting male prisoners? What have been the regulations so far in New York State?
Well, incarcerated parents, mothers or fathers, retain their fundamental right to be involved in their children's lives. They don't forfeit their parental rights when they go to prison. In general, New York has, at least on paper, fairly liberal visiting policies. And at least in the women's facilities, there are often separate special visiting days for children. In fact, I have to say, to be honest, that men probably have a more difficult time visiting their children than women do. I think one of the biggest issues for visiting in New York State is that the largest women's facility, which is Albion, is up near Rochester. It's about 8 hours away by bus. Most women who are incarcerated throughout the state come from New York City. So you have children who are perhaps with elderly relatives. You have children who are in foster care. It's very difficult to get a child on that, you know, 8-hour bus ride both ways, a 16-hour round-trip bus ride up to Albion to visit a mom.
I wanted to bring Lisa Turner into the conversation. You experienced the prison system for the last two and a half years. Can you talk about your time there? You were also a mother.
My time there, it was difficult being away from my children. I'm a mother of two children. I have a 20-year-old and a 6-year-old. And it was difficult for me, but I was able to adjust. But I believe that it was more difficult for my children, being away from my children. And because it wasn't the first time, unfortunately, that I was away in prison. So the adjustment for my children were really difficult.
You raised, who raised the kids while you were in jail?
My grandparents did. My youngest son, he's with my brother, and my oldest, who is now 20 years old, he was raised by my grandparents.
What kind of effect did it have on them?
Wow, it had a real rough effect, mostly on my oldest. My oldest has been through my past, my prior incarcerations. He's been through them with me. And the effect has been really, I don't know what word to use, but it has affected him greatly. He has a lot of anger. He has a lot of resentment, not being used to not having me there as much as he would have liked for me to be there. So, coming home, kids, they get into a state where they don't trust anymore because they don't know if mom is going to be there or how long mom is going to be there. So it's a scary situation, and it puts you in a position where you have to work with your children when you come home to help to reinforce them that you're not going to go back or that you're going to get it right this time.
And in terms of your ability to maintain relationships with them while you were incarcerated, how often were you able to see them, and what was the relationship like during the incarceration period?
During my incarceration, I wrote my son a lot of letters. He wrote back whenever I guess he felt like it, or, you know, his anger didn't allow him to. He didn't know how to express himself. I was fortunate to get to see my children while I was incarcerated. A lot of women don't have that opportunity, just like Julie said, because of the distance, or because of the funds, because they're not able to, you know, to have any transportation to bring the children to the mothers while we're incarcerated. But I was fortunate to get to see my children while I was incarcerated.
Tanya Kruppet, you're with the Administration for Children's Services, ACS, in New York, and you deal with specifically children of incarcerated parents. What are the issues that you're finding?
Well, CHIP, the Children of Incarcerated Parent Program at ACS, was formed almost 3 years ago. We're celebrating our third year anniversary in June to address many of the issues that Julie and Lisa talked about, and focusing on the unfortunately growing population of children whose parents are incarcerated, and to address a lot of the barriers that they face, specifically in child welfare. Again, there's the distance when we serve mothers and fathers, so when the parents are incarcerated far away, and then the resource issues, and also within child welfare, there hadn't been a lot of cross-training, so within families' lives, the criminal justice and child welfare systems overlapped, but on a systems, policy, and practice level, they did not overlap. And so through the CHIP program, it's a unique effort of two city agencies, which is the child welfare and the Department of Corrections, coming together to acknowledge this overlap within families' lives and to do something about that. So part of the program includes a visiting service, a weekly service to Rikers Island, the world's largest jail. They have about 17,000 inmates at any one time, and currently about 1,200 women incarcerated on Rikers Island. So every Tuesday, we go to Rikers Island, and that day, the Department of Corrections designated for us as the foster care visiting day. So because we're only bringing children in foster care, as mothers are there and fathers are there, on that specific day they made the procedure more child-friendly, which is very important because in addition to the distance and the logistical and resource barriers, the visiting procedures were not really set up to be child or family sensitive.
What about the issues of when a mother has to give up custody of her child in prison?
Well, there's many issues, and Julie spoke about retaining your parental rights, and in foster care, when parents are there, there are certain regulations. We're mandated by law to bring the children on a monthly basis, at least monthly basis, to see the parents. And then we try to work with foster parents to be sensitive. Of course, there's a huge stigma and a lot of assumptions made when a mother's incarcerated that if she cared about her children, she wouldn't be there. And what we hear from the children and see in real life is that that's just not true. And so we do a lot of training with caseworkers and foster parents.
Lisa, how do you respond to that? If you cared about your kids, you wouldn't be in prison.
I can only speak for myself because I come from a background. I'm an addict in recovery, and addiction was an obstacle for me. So it wasn't because I didn't care about my children that, you know, that I wasn't there. It was my addiction, and I didn't know how to deal with my addiction. I didn't know what to do about my addiction. The obsession and the compulsion just, you know, it overwhelmed me. And once I got into a state of mind where the fog began to clear, yes, I wanted to be with my children. Yes, I wanted to be a mother to my children. But again, my addiction was an obstacle for me, which I believe it is for most women.
Speaking about the addiction issue, though, about what percentage of the women who are incarcerated are you finding is it related to drugs?
About 80% of women who are incarcerated in New York are self-identified substance users when they go into prison. And so if you imagine that 80% is self-identified, there's some percentage in that 20% that also are addicted and don't acknowledge it. You know, I wanted to mention one more thing, which we haven't spoken about yet, which is a law called the Adoption and Safe Families Act. And when you asked me earlier about significant obstacles for incarcerated parents, this is a national law. It was passed in 1997, and it was one of these incentive laws where states were encouraged to pass an analog to it to be able to continue to get their foster care subsidies. And what ASFA says, and it's a little more complicated than this, but in its essence, and this applies to all parents, not just incarcerated parents, that if your child is in foster care for 15 out of the last 22 months, that the state must begin a proceeding to terminate your parental rights. Now, the significance of this for incarcerated parents, and New York has this same law, and there are exceptions to it, but the significance of this law in New York State, where we have, for example, the Rockefeller drug laws, and you mentioned how many women who are incarcerated are substance users. Most women, again, in New York are incarcerated for drug crimes. You can be incarcerated for 1 to 3 years for selling a $10 vial of crack. When you overlap that with this 1522 rule, as we call it, there are many, many women in this state who are facing, and nationwide, because this is a law that's in effect now nationwide, that are facing losing custody of their children because they become incarcerated. And I'd just like to emphasize that this is not because there's been...
And when was this law passed, and as part of what overall legislation?
The Adoption and Safe Families Act was passed by Congress in 1997. In New York, it was passed in 1999. And these are women who have not had any allegation of abuse or neglect against them. I just want to emphasize that it's not as if these are women who already had a case with ACS or another child welfare agency. It's simply because of the time frame.
So in essence, then, if, for instance, you were in an abusive relationship, you ended up killing your abuser, you would then go to jail, and the courts could terminate your parental rights.
Correct.
Under that situation.
Correct. If your child is in foster care, non-kinship foster care. And there are exceptions to ASFA. One of them is if there's a compelling reason not to document, not to terminate parental rights, but that would, again, require documentation of a compelling reason, which, again, is why visiting becomes so important, because if the mother and the child aren't seeing each other, the caseworker has never had any contact with the mom in prison, they're not going to have a compelling reason to document.
The Administration for Children's Services in New York is unfortunately well known in minority communities as being much more willing to take away children from black and brown parents in New York City. What is your response to that, Tanya Kruppet, as someone who is director within the agency, director of the Children of Incarcerated Parents Program?
Well, I work within the Division of Foster Care and Preventive Services, so we work closely with children who are already placed in foster care, so I'm not involved in the removal. So once children are involved with ACS, if there's an identified involvement with the criminal justice system, then our program tries to step in as early as possible and to make sure that those family bonds are maintained when in the children's best interest. And Julie mentioned ASFA, which I think we want to step in and act as quickly as possible to put in place the visiting, the permanency planning, all the contacts that are needed. And then one of the exceptions, New York is fortunate in this, when the Administration for Children's Services issued their guidelines on implementing ASFA, one of the exceptions to filing for a termination, the compelling reasons that were mentioned, is if the parent's incarcerated, there's a significant bond between the parent and the child, and it's believed that reunification can happen in a reasonable time frame. So we work hard to maintain the family bonds, even when a parent's incarcerated.
And Lisa Turner, what about the while you were incarcerated, is there more organizing going on among the women to try to assert their rights, look for advocates outside the jails to support them in their rights, to have more access to their children and be able to exercise their parental rights more?
Yes, it is. There is a tremendous amount of women who are active, who look for outside help, who look for advocacy, who look for ways that they can spend more time with their children. I was in Bedford State Correctional Facility, and they have a wonderful children's program. They have all kinds of ways for you to stay in touch with your children, to get bonded with your children. They have trailer visits. They have a storybook corner where you can read your child a story on tape and mail it to your child. It's a whole lot of things that the women get involved with, that which is a good thing, because just because they're incarcerated doesn't mean that they have to stop being a parent.
But, you know, one of the things people often talk about Bedford, and I agree with Lisa that Bedford has some wonderful programs. Bedford is one prison among the five. Bedford is pretty much the only prison that has the programs that Lisa is talking about. So if you're up in Albion, there is a small children's center. There aren't nearly the number of services, people coming in from the outside, as there are in Bedford. So Bedford is a gem of the prison system, if one can have such a thing, but it's unique.
Right.
And most women are not incarcerated at Bedford.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. We've been talking to Tanya Crippett, Director of Children of Incarcerated Parents, CHIPS Program Administration for Children's Services, Lisa Turner, a former prisoner who came out of the system, recently graduated from Project Green Hope, which is an alternative to incarceration program, and is involved with Reconnect, a leadership institute with the Women in Prison Project, now an HIV/AIDS peer education program counselor, aspiring to be a substance abuse counselor, and Julie Cowitz, who is with the Women in Prison Project, director of the project here in New York City, an attorney with a background in women's rights. Thank you all for being with us. If people want to get in touch with your group, where can they call or go on the web?
They can go on the web at www.correctionalassociation.org. Our phone number is 212-254-5700. And I strongly urge those of you who go on the web to look at our project, that you take a look at a big event that we have coming up, which is a dramatic reading of a play called Getting Out, which is about a woman getting out of prison. It's coming up June 9th, and there's more information on the website, but it's an exciting reading with Hilary Swank, Danny Glover, and Jill Clayburgh.
Lisa, the hardest thing when you came out?
The hardest thing when I came out was readjusting back into society, because once you're incarcerated, if you allow it to, it would take away your enthusiasm. It breaks your spirit if you allow it to. But with the help of outside resources, I was able to bounce back, and I'm learning now that my experience is really powerful. So I'm taking my experience and I'm making it work for me.
Well, thanks all for being with
us. Thank you.
You're listening to Democracy Now! We come back. Mothers from around the country, what they're doing about Mother's Day. Stay with us. Home, Sweet Honey in the Rock, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In 1870, author, abolitionist, peace activist, suffragist Julia Ward Howe attempted to get recognition for a national Mother's Day holiday as a, quote, worldwide protest of women against the cruelties of war. Howe called for women to rise up and protest on Mother's Day. She declared, "Arise then, women of this day. Arise, all women who have hearts. Whether your baptism be of water or of tears, say firmly, we will not have questions answered by irrelevant agencies. Our husbands will not come to us reeking with carnage for caresses and applause. Our sons shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we have been able to teach them of charity, mercy, and patience. We, the women of one country, will be too tender of those of another country to allow our sons to be trained to injure theirs." Well, in that spirit, a series of rallies, protests, and celebrations are being held in an attempt to return Mother's Day to Howe's original vision, a day of activism, resistance, and women's solidarity. Yesterday, Democracy Now! Producer Angie Caron spoke to a number of mothers to find out what their plans are for Mother's Day.
This is is Lynn McMullen, and I'm from Olympia, Washington. And I've been a development consultant over the last 2 decades on international policy issues and really saw that what was missing to address them adequately was political will in the United States to really address the problems. And so I decided to recruit a group of women, really mothers, to go see the AIDS pandemic face-to-face in Southern Africa. And we visited orphanages. 37 women went, and we visited orphanages, hospitals, hospices, and places where there were absolutely no health services. Really extraordinary. And we came home, really, to educate our communities by doing Mother's Day events. We're doing them in 10 cities, and tell the personal stories of the people that we met. This health crisis, AIDS, is the largest crisis of health crisis of modern times. And right now we have 11 million AIDS orphans in Africa, and they're projecting up to 40 million by the year 2010. And so we really saw that we needed to find a way to bring the U.S. role into a higher profile. So we're really a group of women who are standing together as mothers for the fundamental worth of every human being, and really urging the U.S. government. You know, we have $2 trillion in our government, and we're saying that the U.S. spending $1.7 billion in the Global Fund would be a worthy down payment, that and some deeper debt relief. So we're really trying to cause a movement here, and next year we plan to take 100 women to witness AIDS and another 25 to visit former and current conflict zones and really educate Americans on what's happening in the world and how it's affecting them. So here in Olympia, we're organizing our parade, and we're going to be carrying a coffin down the streets of our capital that says AIDS, poverty, war, and debt on it, really to educate Americans and deepen the understanding of how all of these global issues are affecting the world's children.
Hello, this is Dr. Eileen Ains speaking with you, and I'm from Mothers Acting Up in New York City. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about the activities going on that I know of. First, there's the New York City Mothers Acting Up first ever annual rally. And begins with a walk from the LaGuardia Place Community Garden, and we're going to have stilt walkers and musicians, and I'm going to be the Pied Piper playing the flute. And banners, and we're going to march into Union Square South. In the Union Square rally, we have belly dancing, and we have yoga, and we have beautiful storytelling with Laura Sims, and we have Lynn Stewart speaking on mother's responsibility in an unjust world. And we're going to rally to celebrate the collective energy that moves political action. And we've selected three actions for the protection of children. The first is the signing of the UN Convention for the Human Rights for Children's Rights for all children. And then secondly, we're going to ask that GMOs done away with so that our food is nutritious and chemically balanced. And then the third is to stop budget cuts for education. And the fourth is one that you do your own. And on our rally, we're going to be joined by many other groups. There's going to be the Raging Grannies and some people from Mama Palooza and another group called Mothers Rising Up. The other groups would like to collaborate so that the mothering energy is well protected so that we can move along and to support love, education, and health care and the best for all children. So I hope you join us, and it's good speaking with you, and I'll see you on Mother's Day. Bye-bye.
Hi, my name is Colleen Freeman, and I'm from Avon, New York. I work as an interpreter for the deaf at the Rochester Institute of Technology, and I'm a mother of three children. I recently traveled to South Africa with 36 other women to witness firsthand the devastation of the AIDS pandemic in that country. South African women are working day after day, week after week, without pay or government subsidies to do whatever they can to care for their dying people and the children left behind. I held one little girl, a year and a half old, HIV positive, so sick with pneumonia and so frail she could not support her own head. As I held her over my shoulder and sang to her, I will never forget how it felt to have her chest heaving against mine as she struggled to get every breath. My heart is with the heroic women working at the grassroots level every day to try and turn the tide of this pandemic. I am gathering a group of women eager to work with me to set up a nonprofit organization that would enable us to get 100% of any monies we collect directly to these women on the front line. I will be putting together a videotape from my recent travel there to use in presentations at schools, organizations, or with anyone willing to listen to help spread awareness as to what is happening in South Africa.
Hi, this is Leslie Eamon, and I'm calling from Albuquerque, New Mexico. I am a mother acting up and one of the women organizing the Mother's Day Parade in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Our parade will happen on Sunday, May 11th at 12 p.m., when hundreds of New Mexico mothers and others who care for children will get on stilts and dress up in costumes and wild hats to sing, drum, and dance down Central Avenue to Roosevelt Park for a gathering to act. Our action will include letters to our Senate member of the Appropriations Committee, the President, and other members of the administration asking that they support debt relief and the use of the Global Fund to fight AIDS in Africa. We will be inspired by the spirit of Julia Ward Howe and the words of Peggy O'Mara of Mothering Magazine. Our parade will demonstrate the exuberant power and gigantic political strength of mothers to make this world a better place for all children, not just a privileged few.
Well, that does it for today's program. We wish you all a happy Mother's Day on Sunday. And on a final historical note, the woman who was the power behind the official establishment of Mother's Day in the United States, Anna Jarvis, became increasingly concerned over the commercialization of the holiday. She opposed the selling of flowers and also the use of greeting cards, which she said, quote, are a poor excuse for the letter you were too lazy to write. She also said, quote, I wanted it to be a day of sentiment, not profit.
We want to thank the producers of today's program, Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Vil Katsouris. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. If you want to get a copy of the show, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359, our website, democracynow.org. And we are looking for volunteers at our Firehouse studio here in New York. You can send a note to volunteers@democracynow.org. That's email. As we go out with the words of a child sending a note to her mom in jail.
Hi, my name is Shante. I'm 12 years old. Mom, if you hear me, I want to wish you happy Mother's Day, and I love you very much. I hope you're enjoying yourself, because I'm enjoying myself. I'm doing very good in school, and I miss you very much, and I can't wait to see you. And I hope you have fun no matter what you do. And no matter how far away you is from me, you're not that far, because you're still in my heart. So, happy Mother's Day, Mommy. I love you.
I wish I could say all the things that I should say.
I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Happy Mother's Day.
Say I'm clear for the whole round world to hear.